Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for April 19th, 2013.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
Trees that live a really long time tend to grow slowly throughout the majority of their lives.
You could think of it almost like if an island coming out of the ocean with nothing on it. How would things get there and what order would they get there in?
Normally, if you want to find a few kilometer wide goal after 3,500 kilometers, you need to have a map. But these guys don't have a map.
We kind of are sliding them across the surface and able to measure the actual force it takes to make them slip.
This week, why geckos appear to defy gravity, how monarch butterflies migrate without a map, why some trees live for thousands of years, and some slimy alien invaders. But first, Suzanne Bard investigates the strange worlds within carnivorous plants.
Carnivorous pitcher plants are more than just interesting oddities. According to community ecologist Ben Baser at Harvard Forest in Massachusetts, each pitcher plant contains a unique and complex food web.
The plants produce new leaves every spring, and when each leaf opens, they're completely sterile. They fill with rainwater, and then an insect comes and falls in. Well, at the same time insects are falling in, propagules colonize the plant. And so species such as bacteria or protozoans can sometimes come in on the legs of the insect, or sometimes just blown around in the air. And the mosquito larvae deposit their eggs within the open pitcher. Mites and midges also deposit their eggs. And so all of these organisms kind of colonize the pitcher. You could think of it almost like if an island coming out of the ocean with nothing on it, how would things get there and what order would they get there in? And the midge is the first one, which shreds the ant or the wasp that falls in. So it's a shredding midge, which shreds it into finer pieces. These finer pieces allow for bacteria to get more surface area and start decomposing the prey that falls in. The protozoans eat the bacteria. And then the mosquito larvae and other top predators, such as rotifers, then eat the protozoans. And then their waste is nutrients that is soaked up by the pitcher plant. And that's the whole kind of ecosystem mechanism of the plant drawing the insect in to gain these nutrients.
Baser says if one element in the pitcher plant food web changes, such as too many trapped animals, it affects the entire web.
So whether it's that just a whole bunch of ants fall in or something larger, like maybe we've seen a newt that falls in, and the whole system turns anaerobic, so it loses all its oxygen. And this completely changes the dynamics of the system in terms of what species are there. It changes the bacterial community, and a lot of the invertebrate species that are in there go extinct, and shows how the pitcher plant is a model system for looking at ecosystems, because that's the same thing that happens in a lake that gets overloaded with nutrients, say from nitrogen runoff, and then has an algal bloom and then goes anaerobic.
Thanks for that report, Suzanne. The oldest age ever recorded for a human being is 122 years, but the oldest known tree is a 5,000-year-old bristlecone pine still thriving in the mountains of California. Listener Claudine Boudel wants to know why some trees live so long. We consulted applied forest ecologist Sarah Johnson of the Nature Conservancy. She says the longest-lived trees have several things in common. They put a lot of energy into the maintenance and defense of their tissues, and they grow extremely slowly compared to other plants.
Trees that live a really long time tend to grow slowly throughout the majority of their lives. The growth rate will typically slow down as any tree gets older because of the physiological cost of moving water and nutrients throughout that larger and larger object. So any tree is going to experience a slowing in growth rate when it starts to reach its maximum lifespan. And that just helps it to maintain itself for longer.
She adds that the oldest trees live in inhospitable environments, which slows down their growth even more.
So a bristlecone pine will be growing on a rock outcrop where there's barely any soil, and that has contributed to its long life.
And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we answer your question on the show, you'll win a Science Update mug. Next, correspondent Justin Warner reports that Florida is under attack from slimy, vegetable-eating, tire-puncturing aliens.
As we speak, South Florida is battling an alien invasion, but the creatures aren't from another planet. They're giant East African land snails, which can grow to the size of rats and have voracious appetites. In fact, according to entomologist Trevor Smith of the Florida Department of Agriculture, the snails can literally eat you out of house and home.
As you can imagine, an 8-inch snail has a very large shell, and it's very thick. And to build that, they need quite a bit of calcium. So if they can't find limestone or maybe a cement block or something on the ground, they'll just climb up on the wall of the house and start eating the stucco. So not only are they a plant pest, but they can actually eat your house.
As for plants, they're not picky. They'll eat just about anything in their path. And unlike in their native East Africa, the snails have no natural predators or parasites in South Florida to keep their population in check. What's more, each snail lays about 1,200 eggs a year.
And that's a conservative estimate. We have a population here in our quarantine facility in Gainesville, and we've seen snails that can produce 2 or 3 times that number in 1 year.
The snails were first spotted in South Florida just 19 months ago. It's unclear whether they came as exotic pets, stowed away on shipping containers, or arrived by some other means. But since then, authorities have hand-captured 118,000 snails, and they're expecting a bumper crop to come out of hiding in the coming rainy season.
And in fact, that's what makes these things difficult in general. If conditions aren't right, it's getting too dry, they're not finding the right amount of food, they basically just will go to ground, kind of bury themselves a little bit. They create a little film across the aperture so they don't lose any moisture, and they'll go into a hibernative state until things are better. And then they basically wake up and come back out and go back to business as usual.
Authorities have been collecting them by hand from infested properties and leaving baits laced with iron, which is toxic to the snails. Thanks to a massive public information campaign, most of the core snail populations were actually discovered by private citizens. Although it's a tough job, Floridians beat a smaller giant snail infestation in the mid-1960s, and Smith's confident that they can do it again.
Thanks, Justin. Next, most people know the gecko as a cartoon spokesman for a car insurance company. But to material scientists, geckos are gold mines because of their ability to stick to walls and ceilings and yet release their grip in an instant. Suzanne tells us about the latest research into the gecko's sticky properties.
Science labs aren't all about petri dishes and microscopes. For instance, University of Akron biologist Alyssa Stark harnesses small lizards called geckos to a tether and gently yanks them off various surfaces. The tether's attached to a force sensor.
So we kind of are sliding them across the surface and able to measure the actual force it takes to make them slip.
The lizards are interesting to scientists because they can run upside down on wet surfaces. So they're strongly adhesive but easily detached. Stark's lab has found that generally, the more the surface itself repels water, the better the gecko sticks to it. The results may help develop synthetic adhesives, from reusable underwater tape to internal bandages that stick and release like gecko feet.
Thanks, Suzanne. Every fall, monarch butterflies migrate from North America to a few parts of Mexico. It's known that they use the sun as a compass. But it was also widely assumed that they have a mental map of their route, like homing pigeons do.
Normally, if you want to find a few kilometer wide goal after 3,500 kilometers, you need to have a map. But these guys don't have a map. And that's quite surprising.
That's biologist Henrik Morwitzen of the University of Oldenburg in Germany. His team proved the butterflies rely on their compass alone by moving a population from Ontario, 1,500 miles west, to Calgary. The relocated butterfly still tried to migrate southwest, which wasn't the right direction anymore. Mortensen says that normally, simply following the coastline helps the monarch stay on track. Well, that's all we have for you this week. Next week, could lasers wipe out cocaine addiction? Until then, tune in to the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition, every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.